This is side two of tape seven of the continuing oral history interview with Professor Tom Schaub of the Department of English. Today's date is December 20th, 2006. Tom, when we left off the last time, you had just been elected chair of the Department of English for the first time. And you had not been at the university all that long at that point.
No, that's true.
And you were now stepping into leadership of one of the major liberal arts departments.
Yes, and I think I spoke on the earlier tape about the reasons that people thought I might make a suitable leader for the department. The prospect for me was one of curiosity about what I would learn about the university, because I knew that now I would be involved in chair meetings with the dean, that I would become a member of committees all over campus, and I'd meet people from other departments. And I saw that as a real benefit. At the same time, I was sort of learning the ropes, naturally. I hardly knew anybody on campus. I'd only been there 6 years. And I was busy most of that time writing my second book. So between that and family and whatnot, I wasn't really making lots of friends around campus. So, but I would say the two major events of that first three-year chairmanship were the fact that the legislature put a hiring freeze on the college during those years. And the other is that I discovered within a month or two of becoming chair that there was a committee meeting to reestablish the writing and rhetoric requirement at UW-Madison, and that there was no one from English on the committee.
Is that true?
That's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And so I'll start with let me talk about the hiring business. We had permission to hire one faculty member. And so if you had permission before the freeze came down, you were allowed to continue to search. Whether or not you would be allowed to hire would be another matter. Now, I think it was in the prior year, probably the prior year, we had hired a woman in the Renaissance area, a Shakespearean, named Suzanne Wofford from Yale. And she had just come out with her much ballyhooed and stupendous book on the epic. And we felt that having Suzanne here, twice decorated teacher at Yale, was a great coup for us. And because we were, as a department, I think we had been in, I think people would agree with this, that there had been a kind of decline in the department's reputation since the days of Helen C. White and who are some of those early names? Of course, I didn't know them myself. Let me think. The guy in the 18th century that preceded Howard and Philharth and Eric Rothstein. I can't recall. But anyway, the department had been ranked in the top 10 in the country back in the 40s and 50s. And that was generally true of the Midwest. You know, people like Warren of Warren and Wellick were at Iowa. Mm-hmm. Minnesota had a gangbuster English department. So that the effects of migration to the West Coast in particular hadn't yet been felt. Mm-hmm. Wellick and Warren, of course, both ended up at Yale. But there was, even as recently as 1980-something, a former president or dean of Harvard wrote a book about higher education. And he spoke of Wisconsin in the same breath with Berkeley and Chicago and Yale and Harvard. Hmm. And I think by 1986 or so, that was no longer true. And it was felt in this department that the reason for that was twofold. One, that we had given up on the writing requirement. We refused to teach writing and composition in the English department. And I may have mentioned this before, but it was sort of a something that we had to do because the English department composition classes were fomenting the riots on campus and in the early 70s. And the strikes that the teachers' unions were, the student TA unions were establishing or running. And, you know, I don't really know the ins and outs of this, but I think Charles Scott was chair at the time. And he told me about the English department at that time was at Bascom Hall. And the room where it used to hold its English department meetings was the... you know, the hall where the Faculty Senate now meets. Oh. And he said there was just an immense meeting with the press and the public and the English department, faculty. I mean, it was just standing room only that he had that he ran to talk about the problems that were being created and what to do about them. And so, as I say, you know, you can't take me as the... as the expert on that moment, but at any rate, the upshot was that English stopped teaching its composition courses. You know, at one point during that period, the English department had something like 600 graduate students at a crack.
Really?
Oh, just an immense PhD mill. And turning these kids out, you know, year after year. And, of course, this had to do with, I think, the deferments, which still... covered graduate students, perhaps, as I know that deferment was dropped in the fall of 69, but so in any case, so that was one thing. We stopped doing that. Therefore, we no longer were able to offer jobs to TA. So the graduate program shrank precipitously, and it was a good thing. I mean, what kind of a graduate program is that? But I think it was a good thing. I say that glibly. Maybe it is good to have 500 graduate students and all the benefits that accrue therefrom. But in any case, the program shrank. The other thing was David Cronin, who recently died, became the dean of the College of Letters and Science. And again, I can't sort or sift truth from fact and truth from fiction in this regard, but it was the view in this department that David Cronin felt that English was too large and that that it didn't merit the kind of funding, I suppose, which means numbers of faculty that it had had, while history, on the other hand, was built up during the Cronin years as dean. Now, again, you'd have to check the record, but this is the story that was told within English. And so when I felt that I had to storm the walls here because there was this meeting going on once a month or more often being run by Lloyd Bitzer and Lee Hansen. And
Lloyd Bitzer of Communication Arts.
Of Communication Arts and Lee Hansen of Economics. Uh-huh. And I said, you know, I wrote directly to David Ward in triple caps saying, hey, what's going on here? You know, you need to get English involved. We're the people that are the natural department to turn to if you want a communications requirement to be reestablished. English should be involved. And I was... who knows how you pick up these things? Maybe I got it from Stan Henning. I certainly talked to Stan about the history of this thing. Mm-hmm. And I think I may have emailed Bitzer or Hansen or somebody. But anyway, I picked up a kind of sketch that, well, we didn't think English was interested in this anymore.
Tom, let me ask you, what was the source of the committee? Was this a chancellor-appointed committee?
This was a chancellor's appointed committee. It was a special committee appointed by the chancellor who had determined, I believe, that Wisconsin needed to have communications requirements. And there was a committee set up to design those requirements, and English was not on it. I thought it was unbelievable too, Bob, and so I got a, let's see, what happened? I got an invitation finally. I was invited to speak to the committee. And it was an entirely unproductive half an hour, however long I was there. People from science and all over campus asking me, you know, what's so bad about grading student papers? Why can't you grade student papers? And, you know, they had no idea that our teaching roles are already full to bursting. You know, we're doing our teaching, and we teach writing within our courses, and we read those papers. But it's not as if we have a staff of people left over to teach freshmen and sophomores how to write. I mean, they just had no sense of the whole thing. And I think they imagined that, as many people do outside academia, that that's what we do in English departments, is teach composition. Mm-hmm. And so our people within academia are really no more savvy about it than anybody else. So nothing much came out of that. And then there was a meeting with the dean of the of Letters and Science at that time, who was Crawford Young. And he met with me and Marianne Fitzpatrick, who was at that time chair of Communication Arts. That was the department that Lloyd Bitzer was a member of. And she and I saw eye to eye immediately. And I remember Crawford Young saying to us, well, couldn't we teach rhetoric and composition in large lecture courses of 300 students? And both of us said, well, this is ridiculous. You can't teach writing or speaking in courses of that size. Mm-hmm. How do you, for example, assign students, how do you give a student an assignment to speak to the class when you have 300 students in the class? You know, you'd be here till eternity. And similarly with the writing. And the writing is such an intimate, difficult, complex thing that this needs to be done in small classes. And I had, you know, I tell you, you hear this phrase, well, I did a short study. Well, as soon as I found out about this, I got in contact with Marty Nystrom and Brad Hughes and who else did we have down there at the time? Maybe Deborah Brandt. So what's the model? How is writing being taught at Cornell, at Harvard, at Berkeley, and so on? Well, they very quickly filled me in with the current way in which writing was being taught across the curriculum and across the nation and in various schools that we like to think of ourselves as being in comparison, being in the same ballpark with. And so I said to Crawford, I said, you know, it just would be, we would be made a spectacle of if it was learned that this is how we were trying to teach rhetoric on the cheap. This is how they do it at Harvard. This is how they do it at Berkeley. I mean, you know, I had the curriculum there. I had handouts and examples of what was being done at peer institutions. And so I don't really know what happened to that committee, the Chancellor's Committee. I really don't know what happened to it.
You were never appointed to it?
I was never appointed to it. They never changed the membership of the committee. But Mary Ann and I really developed a kind of insurgency. It was very much a battle. I collected, and you'll be very much disturbed to hear this, but I collected all the email from, really, which was a three-year prolonged engagement with Lloyd Bitzer and Lee Hansen. You know, it was probably a foot and a half high, which I eventually threw out.
I am.
Because I thought I might write something up about it, and just never got around to it. That I remember, this is what happened. The dean, Crawford Young, set up a committee within Letters and Science. So there were these two, and he must have talked to David Ward about this. It wasn't thought to be, who knows what it was thought to be, but in any case, we had our own committee. And there were two members from Agricultural Life Sciences, which had originally, when the university had been really dominated by Agricultural Life Sciences, that's where writing had originally been taught. That's where composition, because it had to do with radio and communications with farmers and people out in the rural areas. Radio to connect the university with so. So, and I've forgotten. I'm sorry, I've forgotten the. I think maybe he was a dean or associate dean of Agricultural Life Sciences, but the member I'll never forget was Margaret Andresen, who was also from Agricultural Life Sciences and somewhere under that rubric, because when we met for the first time and I was chairing the committee for the first time. You know, we had Brad Hughes at the table and Marty Nystrom and, there were six or seven of us, eight of us. The guy that teaches public speaking over in Communication Arts, what was his name? Lucas. I think Lucas was there and Mary Ann Fitzpatrick was there. And I'll never forget the first thing we did, of course, was go around the room and identify ourselves, say a little bit about our interests and so on. Well, when it came to Margaret Andresen, who showed up with a cane, I think she'd recently had something done on one of her legs, or maybe she was even in a wheelchair, I don't know. But she said, something like this. The gist of it was, I know all about how English teaches writing. English teaches students how to pad their papers and to fill their pages with irrelevant garbage. And I mean, it was just a direct attack on English. I mean, so as right away, well, not right away, because I got on the defensive, and you know, to my discredit, responded to her. I mean, this is the way she identified herself. You know, I teach people to speak succinctly and to get to the point, not like English. And she went on and on in this vein. And so I said, well, I think there's any number of us in English who try to get our students to come right to the point. But I wish I had said something like, Margaret, thank you for that helpful contribution, and then moved on to the next person, you know. But I didn't have the savvy at that point. But that was just the beginning of an awareness on my part that this was a battle over what else? It's a battle over funding. And yes, because I think David Ward had said there was going to be something like $3 million set aside to get this new program going, this new set of requirements. And so Agricultural Life Sciences wanted in on it, and Communication Arts wanted in on it, and English wanted in on it. And I don't think there was anybody else at the table. I think those are the three groups. And think of the consequences. Whoever gets the money, you see, has funding available to recruit graduate students.
And this is while the freeze is on.
And this is while the freeze is on. Of course, that was a hiring freeze for faculty and academic staff, but somebody had to do the teaching.
Yeah.
And it was going to be, everybody presumed it was going to be graduate students. And so, you know, we wrote draft after draft. I can remember getting Serena Pondrum involved because she was aware of the history of the university and had been in upper administration herself, and being in the, you know, in the chair's office on the weekends, writing and trying to shape the rhetoric and make the argument why, you know, this should be something, this should be a partnership between English and communication arts. We should be the people running this thing. Well, you know, if either Marianne or I had had our heads screwed on straight, we would have given up on that idea from the very beginning and entered into a kind of three-way coordination with agricultural life studies because, and there might have been somebody there from engineering as well. Because I remember engineering did eventually hire somebody like Brad Hughes for, well, not Brad Hughes, but somebody like Steve Lucas or something to teach writing over in the engineering school. So there might have been somebody there, too. But in any case, this was a very fractious committee. And, oh, I know what it was. Now, this is getting a little clearer. There was some point in which, and these moments are always so interesting, and they show up out of the blue. I am going up to Bascom Hall, I think, to address the Divisional Humanities Committee about something or other having to do with tenure. And yeah, that was, maybe that was a third thing. It was kind of interesting. But in any case, this was probably in January. So it's 3 or 4 months after I found out about this other committee. And I run into David Ward. And David Ward says to me, Can't we have at least one lecture, you know, of rhetoric? Can't we, he seemed to be saying, can't we mollify Lloyd a little bit? Can't we give him a piece of this somehow? And you know, I'd really been talking to my, you know, my colleagues in rhetoric and composition, and I said, I don't think so, David. I mean, we would show up on the national stage if we tried to do something like that. We'd be in the Chronicle of Higher Education. And he said, all right. And he turned around and went wherever he was going. But, and I think from that moment on, there was no, I didn't hear anything more about that committee. And the committee that...
The Chancellor's Committee.
The Chancellor's Committee. Now, that's probably not quite right, but that's the way I remember it. There's just this chance, serendipitous meeting, and David really sort of being stuck between the leaders that he himself had appointed and what he saw coming up from Marianne and me.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the data that we were supplying, I mean, just flooding the dean and the chancellor's office with studies from Cornell and Harvard and elsewhere. And that committee that I was chair of was the committee to implement the communications requirement. That's what that was.
Okay.
So that was probably subsequent to the chancellor's committee. And it worked under Crawford Young's auspices. I think he was dean for, is it 2 years or just one before Phil Certain came in?
Crawford Young was there for 2 years.
2 years, okay. So then the next year, that would have been my second year as chair.
Wait a minute, Tom.
Yes.
There was Don Crawford and then Crawford Young.
Mm.
Don Crawford
That's
left,
right.
And then Crawford Young followed Don Crawford, and Crawford Young was 1 year.
1 year. And Crawford Young is the one who appointed this committee and made me its chair.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And because I see that I started off wanting to talk about the hiring, but we can get back to that. That had to do with Don Crawford. But this was came to be known on campus as the Committee from Hell. I even imagined, even thought at one point of having T-shirts made called the Committee from Hell, or I served on the Committee from Hell, because it was, these meetings were so combative, and because, you see, we were going to implement. That meant that we needed to establish what each require, what would be the communications requirement. Would it be one course? Would it be two courses? Would it be a one course in which students learn both writing and rhetoric, that is public speaking? Just how is this going to work? And what would be the baseline requirements for each course? What would be, you know, how much writing would be done, for example? What would the format be? Who would do the teaching? All of those things had to be hammered out. And I felt from the very beginning that my theory was that that every department probably had at least one course in its specialty, in its, say, one English course that could be converted to a composition class and could be taught by a faculty member. I was really pushing for getting as much expertise in making this as high-powered an introduction to the university as possible for entering students, and to give students from the very beginning a contact with a faculty member. I remember arguing at the time to Phil Certain, who was associate dean at that time, under Crawford. I said, there's no reason why there can't be a kind of small college experience at a large university through this requirement. Mm-hmm. Phil knew better than I that you know, you might be able to do this somewhat, but I don't think he took that very seriously. And as we took it around the university, I mean, Mary Ann and I, who were really, we might even have been co-chairs. But I think I was the chair, I think. I don't know. But in any case, we went around and tried to sell our ideas. We go to departments. There were, we held humanities-wide, science and humanities-wide meetings. One I remember we held over in Mills Hall. In the church over here. What's the name of that? That is. Well, in any case, you know, in the church there, with the where a lot of performances are held, and the place was just packed. You know, on the balconies and the. Everybody was there. It was such a major change at the university level. This thing was going to go all the way across the university. Mm-hmm. So you had, these were going to be university-wide requirements. And, you know, so it's going to have a major impact on everybody. And one thing I found out was that departments did not think that they had a course that they could give up and free a faculty member to teach one composition course. And even if they had been able to, it wouldn't have been able to deal with, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 incoming freshmen. If you wanted to teach them at a crack of about 18 to 20 per class. So, you know, and we were down there, you know, with our calculators. So 20 people per class and 5,200 freshmen. I said, we're going to need these many classes. And, you know, so it went on and on like that. And it was... It was actually a fascinating experience. It was terribly distressing and disruptive of my sleep and my emotions and whatnot. But at the same time, it was a pitched battle that we came out the winners.
This is tape number 8, side 1. Tom Schaub, December 20th, 2006. So, Tom, you were saying you won.
Well,
what does that mean? And when you say a pitched battle, Who were the combatants?
Well, the combatants were, initially, were Lloyd and Lee and their idea of teaching writing and rhetoric in these large lecture courses.
Uh-huh.
Well, that was dispensed with. Then the battle, at least a choice was made to go with the way that composition studies and practice had evolved over the intervening years between 1970 and 1992, 93, 94. But then the question became, who was to do what? Which, you know, is this something that should be spread all around the university, or should it be run through English, or through English and comm arts? Should engineering get the right to teach how to write? And what about agricultural life sciences?
Mm-hmm.
So there were really four vested interests, and at least four different ideas about what kind of writing should be taught and what the goals of that writing would be. And you know, from our standpoint in English, we saw ourselves teaching and still see ourselves teaching critical thinking. That is, it's not just a matter of writing clearly about something prosaic or something known, but it's also a matter of developing the student's interpretive abilities, the student's ability to think through a problem that does not have a obvious or clear-cut answer.
Mm-hmm.
And that the kind of writing assignments that we make in literature classes really challenge students in that way, because they have to come to terms with a piece of literature or a poem or what have you that is quite challenging. It's a difficult matter. So a difficult task,
mm-hmm,
to complete and be clear, to have a clear thesis to support your argument, and so on. So we wanted to teach argument. We wanted to teach critical thinking. And we thought that we were best suited to doing that.
Mm-hmm.
That was really the reason for the battle lines. And I remember the agricultural life sciences guy, not Margaret. I mean, she and I had nothing to do with each other. After that initial meeting, I mean, she showed up regularly for the meetings and would push her point of view. But the other guy, who I'm ashamed I can't remember the name of, was a very nice fellow. And he took me out to lunch one day and gave me the whole history of the teaching of writing in agricultural life sciences. And I still felt that even given that, or given the fact that that particular burden or task or initiative of agricultural life sciences was no longer as central to the ag enterprise as it was or had been 50, 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed to me and to most of my colleagues, no doubt self-interestedly, that really we should be running the show, and the students, there's no reason that ag students can't take a composition course over in English. And eventually it came to be that since we were the majority on the committee, I suppose that was part of it, we decided that the new requirements would be a requirement in writing and rhetoric, with an emphasis on each one, depending upon where you took it. So you could take rhetoric over in comm arts, with an emphasis on speaking, but still having writing requirements that were spelled out by the committee, or you could take a course that emphasized writing with a component of public speaking in the English department class. Well, we eventually, after about a year or less than a year, we put this to a vote. We had it all spelled out, you know, down to the number of pages, the number of rewriting. There had to be rewriting was part of the, you know, writing is rewriting, was one of the adages, and which is true enough. And there should be peer editing, because writing, any writing that's done is always reviewed by somebody else. Mm-hmm. Even the writing that I do, thank God, it goes to somebody else who goes over it and makes suggestions and changes and copy edits and so on. So we thought that process of writing should be taught. That should be the underlying method. And Steve Lucas had his own shtick about the teaching of public speaking. And so we ended up voting, I think, 9-2 or 7-2, maybe it was 7-2, in favor of these requirements and of having them taught by the two departments in collaboration with one another. And so, you know, there were, you know, meetings between the two departments and negotiations and on, you know.
The two departments being English and Comm Arts.
And Comm Arts. And we're really in the driver's seat. And then we had, I remember having a conference on writing. We brought in people from Cornell and Harvard and, I can't remember all of the schools, maybe Rutgers or Ohio, I think. We had somebody from Ohio. It was like a 2 or 3 day conference that, and I might say parenthetically that all of this was nothing that I would ever have done under my own volition. I didn't like the idea of getting up in front of the College of Letters and Science and making an argument on behalf of this or that. I'm no more a fan of public speaking than anybody else is.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I was the leader of this conference and introduced people, and there was an introductory session on the communication requirements. I think David Ward was there to begin with. He introduced me, and then so this was a major consumption of my time during these first 2 years. And so eventually we brought this to the university committee for a vote. And I'm pretty sure, I don't know who else it would have been, it was the university committee. And I had to write a report that the university committee read. And John Wiley was the chair of this committee at that time, or was the, maybe he was the provost, and so he was, but anyway.
Yeah, he was provost. He was under Ward.
Yes, and so Wiley ran the thing, and he had there the dean of the engineering school.
John Bollinger?
Bollinger, yes. And, you know, quicker than you can say Jack Robinson, our vote was nullified, and it was agreed that the composition requirement would be taught in engineering and agricultural life sciences. It was taught in the four departments.
And, really?
Yes. Yeah, and Bollinger, you know, got up to speak and so on. And I felt at the time that I just was unable to muster the rhetoric or the, you know, it was all in the report. And I hadn't realized I was going to run up against this, and so I might have written a different report if I had. But somebody had said to me, make it short, and, you know, they're busy people, and so on. So I should have made a full-bore report and attached an executive summary on top of it. It's probably what I should have done. But in any case, we came out of that with that result, and then it had to be voted on by the entire faculty senate of the university. Mm-hmm. And I stood up and spoke on behalf of the thing, had one of the microphones there, and a number of other people did, and it passed unanimously.
Oh, and so it overruled the university?
No. The motion before the floor, I can't remember how it went. All that they were, I think, voting on was the requirement that there would be a communication A and B requirement, and that these would be their requirements of each.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. And that the money, you know, that would flow as John Wiley and David Ward saw fit, I guess. But with English and Comm Arts running the show in letters and science. And so, of course, we got the bulk of it, since we have something like 92% of all entering freshmen and 56% of all graduating seniors. Mm-hmm. At least that's what it was at the time. So, yeah, it was a very interesting thing. I mean, I got to know Ward and Wiley and Marianne Fitzpatrick, and Lloyd resigned. Mm-hmm. And people, I think Marianne told me that she thought it was pretty directly as a consequence of being shut out of this, you know, his idea being, and I don't know whether that's true or not, but he resigned at any rate. I got to know Lee Hansen a little bit. He and I had discussions, and I got to like Lee quite a bit. And, you know, I'll tell you, for the record, I was acting on behalf of the Department of English. I saw that this would be a great thing for our graduate department. Mm-hmm. I knew that we had to have a large stake in this. That, especially in the current atmosphere of legislative freezes and the decline of the department, that we needed this infusion of money. We needed to be able to say to graduate students, we can guarantee you 3 years of assistance. Mm-hmm. Though we at no point considered using this for the MA, for the first year. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't think it was right to have teaching assistants teaching writing who had only a semester before been undergraduates somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that's not true across the nation or even across the campus, I don't believe. But it's true for the English classes that are taught to meet this requirement. The other thing that we did was, I'm backtracking a little bit, was we decided, and I really like this idea, and I don't know how you would show whether it's done any good or not, but we decided that the Communication A requirement would be a straightforward composition class or rhetoric class, mm-hmm. in which both classes would have elements of both. But the Composition B requirement, we decided, should be faculty taught, and it should be writing in the discipline. Because we thought, and I think this is probably, you know, a mixture of my desire to have young students meet faculty, mm-hmm. and of Brad Hughes' insistence that writing is not just writing. Writing as a historian is different from writing as an English major,
mm-hmm.
or writing as a biology major.
Mm-hmm.
And so the students should have the experience of being taught how to write in a subject of interest to them.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're interested in philosophy, they can take a philosophy course that has communications B credit attached mm-hmm. to it. And we succeeded in that.
Oh, good.
We succeeded in that. And I've taught Communication B courses. I can remember the numbers going up. Brad Hughes was the dynamo behind writing across the curriculum. And he became involved in teaching teachers how to teach writing. Because people in biology or chemistry really felt at a loss as to how they should teach writing in their classes. And so Brad was very instrumental in that and got funding to help out on that. Brad also developed a program that I think was first initiated either at Brown or at Cornell University called the Writing Fellows Program, which is also another thing that came out of this really was a three-year struggle. So then now we have the university provided funding, temporary funding, for a Writing Fellows program. And I remember in the first year there might have been, I don't know, 15 fellows or 20 fellows. And these fellows are top English majors and I suppose communication arts majors as well as history majors. That is undergraduate students who are themselves already very accomplished writers, not just English, but from poli-sci, history, comp, lit, wherever the students come from, where there is writing done, and where they have some sort of record as writers. And it's turned out to be a tremendous program. I don't know how many writing fellows we have now, but I know over the years, the work of Brad and with the Board of Visitors that I'll talk about in a while, we've developed independent, grants and support for the Writing Fellows, an endowment for the program.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know whether we've totally succeeded in funding an endowment to take care of that program, but I know that it's continued to expand, that it's extremely competitive, and that Brad and his minions work with these kids and teach them how to work with the students. And I've taught several of these classes with these writing fellows attached to them, and they are just magnificent, and they do make a difference in the quality of the papers that the professor receives. And that's widely acknowledged across campus. And so I think there are some indisputable pluses that came out of these years.
Tom, how does it happen that a particular class gets tagged with Composition B? Is there a process, and do faculty sometimes not like that?
Oh, I don't think faculty dislike it at all. It's an opportunity. You see, if you teach a Com B course, you're only going to have 20 students in it. So it's a real draw in that sense, because it'll mean that you're dealing with 20 instead of 40 or 35. So there'll be, even though there's more work that the students do
mm-hmm.
in a Com B class, you're working with students that are interested in the subject, and whose writing is therefore going to be a little more motivated. And if you attach a writing fellow to that, we'll go over drafts with the students and meet with them and so on.
it's really a tremendous experience. And I don't know how it works in other departments, but in the English department, the curriculum chair will send out a note asking for your preferences, your teaching preferences for the following year. And it will say, on that email, it will say, in addition to the courses that you normally would teach, I want you to consider offering a topic of your choice as a COMB, or we need people to teach 217, Introduction to American Literature. And so you think, well, it might be kind of fun to offer a course in environmental literature as a kind of first go at it. You could develop the course, which is one of the topics that I developed for a COMB.
Oh.
And it's a plum, you know, it's a very good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting what you say about the writing fellows.
You know, it's a tremendous experience for them.
Yeah.
It goes on their resume. And so it's a win-win. It's a very popular program.
So, Tom, I want to return for a minute to the fact that you are chair of the department and you are chair of this very contentious committee.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm assuming you are still teaching.
Yes.
And doing some research.
Yes.
And this is not an ingenuous question. How does one do all that?
Well, I tell you, it was, you just start working 80 to 100 hours a week. I mean, during those years as chairman, I was in the department when the sun went down almost every night, and I was there almost every weekend, particularly because of this communication arts thing. Mm-hmm. But you know, one of the things that the chair does, or did in those days, was the chair writes all of the nomination letters for the awards that are available for our most prestigious faculty. You know, the graduate awards like the Romnus, the Kellett, and the Whorf, or the Bascom fellowships that are that come out of the Bascom chairmanships that come out of the professorships, I should say, that come out of the chancellor's office. And these are big time affairs. You have to collect recommendations from around the world. You have to, you know, write these people up so that they walk on water, so that they're real. Contributions to knowledge and culture are made clear and as stunning as possible. And I frequently was in the chair's office during Christmas break from, you know, New Year's to Martin Luther King, writing these letters, sitting there in my office, nobody else in the building, working on these things. So that was that's obvious answers. I just gave more time to everything. And then as regards to teaching, the teaching became more you know how it is with one's schedule. You know, if the only thing you've got to do is mow the lawn, why, this is you know, you're gonna get down there with your scissors and do the, you know, do it along the curbing. You're really going to make a project out of it. Mm-hmm. But if you've also got to do all these other things, well, you mow the lawn and then you do this and then you do that. So teaching came to occupy almost no territory of anxiety in my emotional structure whatsoever. It was pure fun because I didn't have time to prepare. And I tell you, I got some of the best teaching evaluations that I've ever gotten during those years when I was chair. Because I would go in there, I knew what I was talking about, so and I would just talk with them, start discussions, lecture off the cuff, and I never gave it a thought. You know, it was just, I it was a way to get out of the chair's office. You know, it was a delight to go in there and talk about literature and ideas and beautiful prose passages and things. It was like the highlight of the day for me.
Tom, did you get a reduced teaching load as chair?
I did. I was reduced to 1-1. So I taught one course every semester.
Uh-huh.
But that's highly unusual. Wisconsin, you know, Nellie McKay said this to me after I'd been here a year or two. She said, you know, Wisconsin works its faculty. You know, you do a lot of work as a faculty member at Wisconsin. You know, my peers around the Big Ten had no teaching responsibilities.
As chairs. Really?
Well, it's a job. It's a job in itself. It's a humongous position. I mean, I had 85 people underneath me, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And I was responsible for their raises, for their curriculum, for awards, for talking to them about anything untoward that had developed, that had come to my attention. There's a lot goes on with that many people, that many classes. You know, we had somewhere between 95 and 100 classes meeting, not including the composition,
mm-hmm.
Every semester. So, you know, I'm responsible finally for, you know, I had this curriculum chair, Stan Henning and I worked together, but I'm the guy that signs off on it, and I have to learn about it. I had to do the budget, and I learned spreadsheets, and and you're not taught how to do these things. So, tremendously interesting and time-consuming.
Are you glad you were chair?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was delighted when it was over. I was delighted to have done it. It's a far more interesting job than people realize, because it has all of these, it has such variety, and it's so challenging. It draws upon, I mean, it requires you to make decisions about things that, as a faculty member, you don't have to make. You can sort of think, well, okay, whatever, or you skip a meeting, or you, you know, you're not the one who has to make the decision.
Mm-hmm.
And just little things, like I had a faculty member come in when I was chair for only maybe a week or two. And the faculty member said to me, I'd like blinds in my office because I hate these curtains. You know, we used to have curtains in all the offices.
Oh.
And mine are really dirty and filthy, and I'd like blinds so that I can, you know, and he gave me all of the virtues of blinds over curtains. And I said to him, well, and I was listening to myself talk to him. And that, it was really then that I knew I was going to be okay. Because I said to him, well, you know, that's really a great idea. I bet nobody likes their curtains. You know, it'd be much better if we all had blinds. And I think I'll begin to, I'll ask Kathy Dock, who was the administrative secretary in the office, I'll ask Kathy to put that on for the capital budget for the English department. And he said, well, no, I don't, you know, I know that you have discretionary funds, and I want you to give me blinds. And I said, well, why should you have blinds and other people not have blinds? And he said, well, because I asked first. Yeah, this guy had a lot of chutzpah.
I guess.
And I said, well, the best I can do is to put it on the capital budget, budget requests that go up every year. And, you know, he left a little nettled, but I realized that that one of the problems with the job was not going to be dealing with my colleagues. I saw right away there's not going to be any problem with this. I'm not going to be intimidated I felt like I dealt with this very well. And that this was a talent that I didn't know I had.
Oh, interesting.
Yes.
Well, that is interesting.
Yes, it was very interesting. To me, it was. And gave me a lot more confidence subsequently in dealing with matters that came up that were much more inflammatory, much more difficult.
Go ahead, Tom.
Just to mention one example, some of the most difficult moments in a department are when a department is making decisions about whom to hire. Because, you know, hiring is maybe the most important thing a department does together as a group, because you're determining the future of your department. Where is the department going to go? Is the department going to go theoretical? Do we need somebody here who can teach theory? Or does it, you know, do we, you know, you always have, in any given moment, slice of time, there are always people who've been there a while and want things to continue the way they are. Mm-hmm. And you've always got the younger folk who want things to go in the new directions that they want to take the department in. So you can get a lot of friction. Mm-hmm. And I remember probably the most violent eruption that took place during that first chairmanship. Actually, it was the second chairmanship, and I can mention it now, is that there were two faculty members that we wanted to hire, and they were, I won't go too much further specifying, but it was a very combative meeting in which one of those faculty members' scholarship was vilified as not being scholarship and maybe not even original. And so when it came down to the vote, vote against making an offer was won by one vote. And when that was announced, put it up on the board, two of the faculty members who were for hiring these people got up and they had something in their hand, maybe the CVs and materials of the faculty members being, you know, of the people we were considering, threw them down on the floor, stood up and said, "I quit," and stormed out. You know, just, I mean, really angry. Cool. And so, you know, you're the chair, so what do you do? Well, you think nothing. I mean, the vote's the vote, that's the way it is. We'll have to work toward collegiality and bringing these people back into the fold. Well, somebody, I think, because I didn't know this, but somebody said to me, you can ask for a new vote if one of the people who voted in the majority says they want to change their vote. So if one of the people who voted against these people said, "I want to change my vote, so I'm in the majority," then it can be brought up again, according to Robert's Rules of Order.
This is side 2 of tape 8, Tom Schaub. So, Tom, you were saying
this faculty vote, you could reconsider it if a member of the majority wished to change his or her vote.
Yes, and a faculty member came up right away and said, I'm willing to change my vote. So I took home that weekend a copy of Robert's Rules of Order. And I read a number of sections, including the one dealing with changing of votes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the most interesting thing that I read in that book was probably in the introduction somewhere, that these rules are, in essence, rules set up to make sure that the will of the body is understood and followed. Mm-hmm. So it's not a matter of, oh, we voted, that's it. You know, you lost, we won. If the process needs to continue in order to make sure that the majority will of the group, whatever that is, be heard, it can, and Robert's Rules provides the mechanisms by which you do that. So I sent out an email to that effect and said there would be a meeting on the I think I held it on Monday. We normally hold them on Tuesdays or Wednesdays, but I wanted to get this done. Because we had these two people were hanging on the, you know, waiting to hear from us. And you know, and when I met with the faculty, many of whom were hostile, of course, because they thought, hey, we got our way, and why are we hearing about this again? So I read the relevant passage. I asked for the comment from the faculty member who had decided to change his vote. And then I reminded them that the point of all of these orders, all of these rules, is that the faculty's wishes be understood, and that the majority prevail. The actual majority. So, because I'd sent out this email, we had a good representation of the faculty, mm-hmm. better than in the original meeting. Uh-huh. Yes, and so the question was, you know, the motion was made again, and then, you know, you always talk inside the motion. Mm-hmm. And there was a moment in that meeting when one of those who felt that the upshot was going to be reversed, spoke of those in favor of these two people as a cabal meeting in the hallways. And I stopped the meeting right there, and I said, you know, it's just that kind of comment that I said at the beginning would not be tolerated. That everybody has a right to his or her view, and that 10 or 15 people share the same point of view is no indication that it's a cabal, and even if they did talk among themselves, what of it? This is a democratic process. So I don't want to hear any more of that.
And that was That was admirable and difficult, I would think.
I tell you, Bob, it was. But it came easily. And again, I was surprised at myself. Because one of my great faults is that I like to please people.
Yes.
And I'm much happier with consensus, with pouring oil on the waters, you know. Much happier doing that than I am, you know, being a martinet or operating some other more high-handed way. And the meeting went splendidly after that. And I discovered that my stature had increased among both sides of the department. And it made things easier for me, because people saw that there were some things that I just wouldn't put up with, that I wanted meetings to be run in a civil way that would allow us to conduct a kind of collegial, mutually respectful discussion, and to respect whatever the decision ended up being.
Tom, as chair, are you allowed to vote on matters like that?
No.
So no one knew your position on these?
That's right. That's right. And I was very moved or very pleased that when, at the end of my first stint as chair, I got a copy of a letter sent to the dean by Charles Scott, for whom I had enormous respect, in which he said to the dean, "Tom has been a wonderful chair," and I mean, the gist of the letter was, "Tom has been fair." And I probably got that letter somewhere, but I thought that was quite nice to hear from Charles Scott, not only because he's a man of considerable stature himself as an administrator and linguist, but because he was the one guy who voted against me for chair.
Oh, that's very good.
You know, and I'd had to be a bit direct with him as well. In this, this might be, I could tell briefly the story of hiring two people at a time when there was a freeze. And this was Donald Crawford. And Crawford, we came up with this linguist for a position we needed in English linguistics. And we got this great guy from Southern Illinois University, who had gotten his PhD at Penn, very cosmopolitan, multilingual guy who was doing work at the cutting edge of his particular specialty. And he gave us permission to hire him. But to hire one person. But we had also interviewed Suzanne Wofford's husband, Jacques Lesra. And Jacques and Suzanne both were getting offers already from, I think Santa Cruz was one of the schools. And there might have been, I think there were, and Harvard was one that offered a position to Suzanne. And I kept pestering, I don't know what other word to use, rhetorically, making the argument. I mean, this is talking about what a great candidate Jacques Lesra is, what a great faculty member he is. It's a way of keeping Suzanne. it's in the college's best interest and so on. That, by the way, is probably the number one thing for a chair to remember. That to always frame your requests as requests that work not only to the department's best interest, but to the best interest of the college. Because, as I've said to a couple of subsequent chairs, there's no sense in getting angry with the dean. The dean has no purpose other than to sustain and increase the stature of the College of Letters and Science. Mm-hmm. In many ways, you're on the same side. It's just that he has a limited number of resources to work with, and so he is weighing competing requests from French and Spanish and, you know, on and on, complex. So I kept, so I said, well, what about, I remember at one point I got Crawford to say, well, you can bring him in as perhaps a halftime appointment split between you and comparative literature. So we brought Jacques in, and what's the guy's name over there in Comp Lit at the time? I've forgotten it now. It always reminds me of Paradise. Well, no matter. This guy Lesru, I mean, you should read the letters that were written on his behalf. People like Harold Bloom and Paul DeMond were writing for Jacques Lesru.
Wow.
Lesru was just the star, you know. He's multilingual. He got a PhD in comparative literature. And, you know, reads German, Spanish, French, you know, just an extraordinary cosmopolitan. And had already translated, you know, as a graduate student, had translated DeMond's famous treatise, Blindness and Insight, and won some award for it. So, I mean, just spectacular. He's got that kind of European education. He just seems to know everything. So I said, you know, we got to hire this guy. You know, get two for one. It keeps Suzanne, bring Jacques here. As a couple, it'd be hard to move them. We get them for life. Just kept making the argument. Well, fine. Sarge Bush was assistant dean at that time. And so I decided, I set up an appointment with Crawford to talk with him about this. And we get in there, and I start talking about Lesru. And Crawford looks up at me and he says, oh, isn't this the same thing that I wrote back to you about last month? And here again, you know, this came out of my mouth. I don't know where this came from. But I said, well, am I boring you? My God, you know, where did this come from? You know, this is not Tom Schaub, you know? Am I boring you? Well, and for some reason or other, Don Crawford, who might have had many different reactions to that, it kind of made him sit up. And so, you know, anyway, we had Jacques. Maybe that was when he said, well, maybe we can bring him in half and half, because comparative literature has a half FTE owed to it by the college. Well, anyway, Comp Lit being Comp Lit, and that's a whole other story that should be told by Phil Certain or somebody else, but there's a very, let me just say, a very dysfunctional department, and really didn't know where its best interests lay. And once Crawford was introduced to Jacques Lesru, that's the key. If you can get this guy in front of him, or her in front of him, then they see, ooh, I'd love to have this guy on my team. Comp Lit apparently went in there and threw a fit. Said, no, we want our own guy, and so on. Well, we ended up getting both Richard Young and Jacques Lesru. I remember writing a letter in late February, in which I said, I gotta make this easy for the college somehow. I said, suppose we delay hiring Lesru until the year after next. So it doesn't cost the college anything. And you're not violating the freeze. And, you know, see, this is one of another thing that I discovered that I enjoyed so much about being chair was the negotiations, the figuring out of, well, what if we do this? Or what if we say, yeah, well, a year from now, so-and-so will retire. That'll free up some money for, you know, so you just start putting together these arguments
And you write things like, I know what difficult position the college is in. I have no desire to make your life any more difficult than it already is. I know you're working with shorthanded funds. You know, I understand where your difficulties lie, Dean. But here's a way that we can, well, we ended up getting both people.
Wow.
And I just...
And kept Wofford, who's still
and
here.
Kept Suzanne Wofford, kept them both, and they're both still here, yeah. And Jacques Lezer has now been elected chair for the English department next year.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, all of that is just, it was, you just obsessed about it. You thought about it constantly. You wake up in the middle of the night with ideas, or I rarely worried about things, but I didn't worry about things negatively. I worried about things positively, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So how can I do this?
Mm-hmm.
How can I do this? And I enjoyed that. I enjoyed writing the nomination letters. Now, the current chair is often farms out part or all of those letters, that letter writing to faculty around the in the department. But and maybe that's, you know, the chair has certainly got enough to do, that he or she doesn't need to be writing such letters. But I really took delight in succeeding on behalf of my faculty.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed, I mean, there's a rhetoric to these things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Wiesenfarth, I went to school on Wiesenfarth's letters, because Joe was a great rhetorician of these letters. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. The English department had a distinguished teacher nominated and awarded every year since, I don't know, since when? 70s, 80s. And so the first year, see, who did we nominate for best teacher? Anyway, whoever it was got it. I think it might have been Deborah Brandt. And then we also got a career best teacher from, which was a system-wide thing that I got for Jim Nelson.
Mm.
This is the way you feel about it, like you got it for them. They, from their point of view, they earned it. From my point of view, you get it for them.
Yeah.
And one year, the nominations committee nominated Emily Auerbach for outreach distinguished teacher,
mm-hmm.
which she certainly is, and certainly deserved it. And she didn't get it. I think that's right. I think that's right. I may have it wrong, or maybe somebody else put her up and they didn't get it. But in any case, when I wrote this thing for her, I did my normal thing. I like to just put a shock and awe in the first paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
Just condense pure quill brilliance in the first paragraph. Like, this person is Albert Schweitzer and, all rolled into one. And then you lay out their career and how it's developing and how...
Mm-hmm.
But there was something about her not having won, I think. And so I decided I need to somehow explain... You know, because most of these outreach things would go to people who taught... I don't know, agriculture, or, you know, hands-on, vocational, outreach stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And Emily does outreach literature and the arts. And so I came up with this phrase, and the last paragraph is always very important, I felt. I said, Emily Auerbach provides outreach for the soul. She got it. That's the kind of... thing, and it might take me, a couple of hours to come up with this last paragraph, yes. And I would put it away and then rewrite it. And, you know, I really made these things, much as I was capable of doing, made them works of art. And I remember it was during that, you know, all this self-congratulatory stuff is coming back. I remember it was during that time that the secretary of the faculty, whose name I've forgotten, I think it was Susan. Any case, you know, it was a predecessor to David Nussoff. And she said, when I die, I want the chairman of the English department to write my letter of introduction.
I'm glad we have that.
On tape, yeah. And you know, you'd get these comments from people that served on these committees.
Uh-huh.
I remember Ken Sachs, who was chair of the history department during those years before he went to Brown. He was on one of the committees that was reading all these nomination letters from different departments, and he said to me, "Boy, that was a great letter you wrote." So I took real pride in my job, and I liked that aspect of it. And you know, the rhetorical trying, how do I get what I want? I like that. And then there was the aspect of learning things about myself that I didn't know I had in me.
Yes.
And that was very good for me. And then there was the hiring of faculty. so I enjoyed all of that.
Tom, was there much personnel management issue that was significant? You know, tenured faculty who were underperforming, or conflict between faculty and students, graduate or undergraduate?
Yeah, I think it was maybe the first or second day I was chair. A graduate student in the English linguistics program was arrested for stalking a student. So I've got the TA union representative is in my office. But fortunately, Charles Scott said, "Look, we're going to take care of this in-house. It's not going to bother you." And it didn't.
Uh-huh.
Let's see, personnel issues. There was the guy who wanted the blinds.
Yeah.
He was a nonstop whiner.
Mm-hmm.
And liked to drum up anti-institutional fervor among the new recruits. Uh-huh. And so he had this, you know, this little group that was always putting I think of it as putting a negative construction on what were neutral acts, or, you know, just put together a committee for something. Well, then you'd hear that so-and-so was saying that you stacked the committee. You know, it just was a little thorn in your side.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, well, what? Stack the committee? What? You know, you go back and look at the members. What is he talking about? You know?
Mm-hmm.
There's always a number of people in any academic department that thinks that, I mean, they're just by nature sort of games players and think that there are games going on, and there are favorites, and they're being cut out of the deal, and that kind of thing. And there was a faction of those, probably no more than four or five, disgruntled faculty for one reason or another, and they were a constant problem. And I with two of them, I tried to talk with them, had no success. You know, I wanted to bring them in.
Mm-hmm.
and get, you know, I'm the consensus guy. You know, that's, that was what I tried to build all the time. I didn't want to work by majorities if I could avoid it. And I finally went to a employee assistance, I think that's the name of it. It's really an outfit that is two or three people there that are sort of counselors for personnel problems. And I explained to the guy the problem I was having. And he told me, he said, you've got a very intractable problem. He said, because what you're describing to me are victim bullies. Their identities are formed and rooted in a sense of themselves as victims. So they don't want to be brought in. You can't buy them off. You can't in any way make them feel that they are part of the mainstream of the department, because that, to do that, they would have to give up being victims. And they like to use their victimhood as a ramrod. They bully. And eventually, when I became chair for the second time, those two people went on the job market and left. And I had at least one faculty member tell me that this was my greatest accomplishment as chair. And then you have the another personnel problem is people feeling that they're not getting the awards that they deserve. Now, you know, I guess you just have to, one has to acknowledge that the world is, you know, the people who are successful are sometimes or oftentimes egotistical. I applied for any number of things that I didn't get, and I really never thought much about it. I'd be a little disappointed because I wanted the time off, or I wanted the summer funding or something. But I know that the university is filled with, you know, top flight performers. The competition is keen, and, you know, that's that. But there are many faculty who feel that they've been cut out of the deck. And we had one member of the faculty who was would not stop with the endless notes to the chair, the cutting out stories about women hitting the glass ceiling and in academia, and it's just on and on. Now, this was a person who was very successful, had a very good salary, who always was extremely productive, and therefore always got good merit raises. She was a very good teacher. But you know, she wanted a Vilas professorship like Howard Weinbrot has got. Well, the Vilas professorship is first of all, there's a limited number of them, and if the people don't die or resign, you can't get one. And I remember one year I did my best for this person, and late in the afternoon, I think it was 6 o'clock or so, I was there, and I got a call from David Ward, and he said, "I'm calling you about this person." I said, "You know, she didn't get the I don't know whether it was a war for a Vilas or whatever it was I put her up for, but he said she's clearly deserving of being recognized, and so I've decided to give her a Bascom professorship."
Wow.
Now, a Bascom professorship is a lifelong thing unless you stop being productive or do something morally backward. And so this was amounted to about $10,000-$11,000 a year for research, for travel, for books, for computers, what have you. This woman was insulting. You know, so this was another kind of personnel problem. Mm-hmm. Now this woman did accept the Bascom, of course. And I would talk with her and explain how she might improve her chances and how to do this, and maybe if she taught full time, she'd get her full salary and so on. It just, things like that. And I always got along with faculty. I almost never had any, except in two instances, I never had any, any kind of fracas in the chair's office. And then there was one faculty member whose teaching was really below grade, and resulted in many complaints. Students complaining, getting calls from parents. At that point, I went down to this person's office and I said to him, I told him kind of feedback I'd been getting. I'd looked at his teaching record. And I said, I don't want to go into any kind of lengthy thing about this. I think the evidence is clear. If your teaching doesn't improve dramatically, you won't be selected to teach in the summer courses. And I knew that he depended upon that summer teaching for an extra $5,000 or whatever. And that was that. Because I was rather outraged about some of his high-handedness, and I certainly didn't like talking to parents who were upset.
Yeah.
So his teaching improved.
Oh, it did.
In fact, he even got a perfect. His students evaluated him as high as you can evaluate somebody, I think, in the subsequent year or so. Just had to let him know. So there were things like that, but pretty rare. In the English department, the chair has always set salaries. And the salaries, the method of setting the salaries is always determined somewhat by the dean, who sends out some instructions. And then there's a kind of a system that's developed over the years. It's handed down from chair to chair. Mike has done something different this year, in his chairmanship.
Tom, did you worry as... This concludes side 2 of tape 8.